Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations at Boston University. Speaking will be author Emil Nakhli. Dr. Nakhli's lecture is titled A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Anthropology Department Professor of International Relations, Augustus Norton.
It's a really great pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce Dr. Nakhli this afternoon. He is a man with a very interesting background. He was born in Nazareth, in Mandatory Palestine, and has maintained some contact with that city, but for many, many years has been in the U.S. and began his professional life as an academic, served for many years as a professor, chairman of the department and so on, at a college in Maryland, Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and became known to me many years ago, probably 30 years ago or so, for his writing on a variety of topics, including work in the context of the Arab-Israeli context, a seminal book on the politics and political institutions of Bahrain, and a variety of articles and monographs. He had, at a certain point, I think, done just about everything he could have done in the academic environment, and about 15 or 16 years ago, was it, decided to accept an offer to become a visiting academic at the Central Intelligence Agency and for something different to do. He stayed there for a year and apparently enjoyed the experience because he stayed on for another year. And apparently he was very much appreciated in that agency because they asked him to stay on permanently. He actually was promoted very quickly in the CIA and rose by the time he retired a couple of years ago to the senior intelligence officer rank, which is equivalent basically to the rank of an ambassador or a career minister in the State Department. Along the way, he established himself in the government as the leading expert on Islamic politics in the Muslim world. I go to Washington to consult from time to time, and it would not be unusual for people to refer not to Dr. Nakhli or to Emil Nakhli, but to Emil, and everybody knew who Emil was. In fact, he told me one time that people really didn't know what his last name was. I suspect briefed the President of the United States a number of times and other senior officials, traveled very frequently in the Islamic world. And during the course of the last 8 years, which ended in January, when, in the opinion of many people, including myself, the United States was involved in a lot of things it shouldn't have been involved in, our speaker was one of the people who saw things correctly, which is to say, who understood many of the mistakes that we were making. In the course of his work, Professor Nakhli became necessarily aware of the extraordinary chasm that opened up between the United States and the Islamic world, of course, particularly after the events of September 11, 2001. And he was one of those people who I know was intently concerned with the alienation of many Muslims around the world from the United States. Though he is not himself a Muslim, he was frequently on the ground in discussions with Muslim intellectuals, radical thinkers, intellectuals, and so on, and had probably as well-developed a sense of what was really going on out there as anyone you would encounter. I would frequently see Dr. Nakhli in meetings in Washington. In any case, when he left the government a couple of years ago, retired, Professor Nakhli, or Dr. Nakhli, Began writing a book, and that book has now been published a couple of months ago, A Necessary Engagement, which is very much focused on the important relationship between the United States and the Muslim world. This is a topic that was the subject of some of those meetings that I happened to attend in Washington, and it's a subject that our speaker tonight has spent an enormous amount of time thinking about. He has both a nuanced and impressive understanding of developments in the Muslim world, as well as practical ideas as to how the differences that still reside and which have been mitigated somewhat, I think, by the advent of the Obama administration, how those differences may be effectively bridged over the course of the next months and years. So, without further ado, please join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, Dr. Emil Nahli.
Thank you very much, Dick, for your very gracious introduction. I'm very proud to have done what I did in the government, and to have focused on this issue and to have engaged so many academics, including several in this room, in that work over the years. Just to illustrate what Dick mentioned, when I started in the government, when I was given this position, the director said, "Well, I haven't done such a position in 25 years. I said, "Thank you. What do you want me to do?" He said, "Write your job description." So I wrote my job description, and that's what I did for all those years in the government. And I will come to those three issues that I focused on throughout the 16, 17 years in the government. But once I accepted the position, you know, I went to the HR person. Now it's called HR. It was like a personnel office. So I said, "What is this GS business?" "Oh," she said, "you know, it starts GS1, GS2, GS3. I said, "How high does it go?" She said, "GS15. I said, "I take that." And then she said, "And we have steps." I said, "What is that?" She said, "15-1, 15-2, 15-3. I said, "How high does it go?" She said, "15-10. I said, "I take that too." So I started 15-10. And then I was promoted since then. But the reason I make this story, I tell this story, is unlike many others of my colleagues, I truly felt free, and I know this is a trite phrase, but felt free to speak truth to power. I did not have to worry about my career. I could have easily retired at 15-10, very nice salary, very nice retirement. I did not really even expect to be promoted. I was. But that gave me the freedom to speak truth to power. Basically, what kind of truth? And Dick alluded to that, the truth that we acquired from the field. That is, the job that I had was basically to direct the Islamic project in the U.S. government at CIA. And why was that established? And here I will begin my presentation. I was very pleased to hear President Obama say a few very important statements in his speech in Turkey. And I also was pleased to see the poll that ABC Washington Post revealed showing that a large majority of Americans favored engaging the Islamic War. President Obama said, "We are not at war with Islam. We will never be at war with Islam." What we have to do is to create a separation between the 1-2%, if you will, that is committed to violence or engages in violence or believes that violence is a method of change, and the 98% or the 99% that, though silent, they might have been about issues of violence and terrorism, but that believes in gradual change and in changing the system and working with the system from within. And this has been a major change, especially in Islamic political parties in the last 19 years, particularly since the early 90s. Now, as Dick indicated, while I was in the government, I focused on three important issues, the most important of which was what we call political Islam. Not Islamic fundamentalism, not Islamism or Islamists. Those two terms, some of you probably know that our publications in the U.S. government do not use fundamentalism and do not use Islamism or Islamists or things of that sort. We use either Islamic activism or political Islam, because the other two really do not give us much analytically to work with as analysts. Now, why did the agency decide to do that? And this is, I discuss this in chapter two in the book, and that is the U.S. response to this phenomenon of Islamization. There's been two general responses from the U.S. government. One response, particularly since 9/11, is to paint the Islamic world with one broad brush of terrorism. That immediately blurred the vision of the Islamic world, and that immediately told the Islamic world that we are at war with Islam. And that was very disturbing to me and to many analysts who were focusing on the Islamic world from within. And I was very fortunate, really, in that position to visit over 30 Muslim countries frequently, from Central Asia to of course, the Middle East, East Africa, West Africa, the subcontinent, Southeast Asia, China, and so on, plus several Muslim minority countries, including Indian and the European countries and Australia and New Zealand. But in these trips, we discovered a phenomenon that we called Islamization in the last two decades. And Islamization, basically, Muslims becoming more aware of their Islamic identity and wanted that identity to govern their existence in society, not just as a moral compass, but some in education, in economics, in the judiciary, in legislation, and so on. So we wanted to focus on that, to understand this phenomenon, to see the diversity of it, and to begin to inform our policymakers about it. So the one response was, unfortunately, from the policymakers, is to paint the Islamic world with the broad brush of terrorism. But the other response was from the CIA, especially the analytic part, so please don't ask me questions about the operational side, but I'm focusing on the analytical side of the CIA, and that is the Directorate of Intelligence. The Directorate of Intelligence concluded that this phenomenon is a long-term issue, is a generational challenge, that we need to understand it. We need to understand Muslim societies. We need to understand why Muslim groups turn to Islam as an identity anchor. What do they want to achieve in both, by the way, lawful and unlawful means? Who does it? What organizations emerge? And so the good news is that expertise, that the agency decided to put expertise, to start building and nurturing expertise in this subject, both resources and personnel, and expertise that would go beyond a four-year presidential term or a six-year senatorial term, a long-term expertise. So that is the good news. Of course, the bad news is that the agency continues to be the only government entity, U.S. government entity, with that type of expertise. Other government entities that deal with that have no resources to put in it. INR has very few people to do to work in that. DIA has very few people to work in that. NSA, of course, they listen. They don't do much analysis of that. And so the CIA really remains the only agency, the only government entity with this type of deep expertise in political Islam. And, of course, as probably the academics among you know, that right after 9/11, we created, two, 3 years later, actually, we created a center called political PISAB, or Political Islam Strategic Analysis Program, which I directed until I left government. And so what are some of the things that we focused on and that the book focuses on? And this is how basically in our briefings, oftentimes, as Dick indicated, solo briefings, that we try to brief the administration on these trends and what was happening in the Muslim world. And the first, of course, is you all know, and this is rather simplistic to many of you, and that is that there is a tremendous diversity in the Muslim world, that the Muslims of Indonesia are not the same as the Muslims of Egypt, that their attitudes are not the same, their cultural experiences are not the same, even though they are unified by one overarching unifier, and that is Islam. And so we try to brief the administration by saying that there's no such a thing as one Islamic world, one Islamic society, one Islamic street, that there are many. And they would get it, you see, during the briefing. And then a week later, a crisis occurs, and then I get this tasking from the White House, what does the Islamic world think about this? I say, what Islamic world are you talking about? So this diversity and complexity are very, very important to keep in mind when we talk about the Islamic world, because we try to kind of plot it on a graph, this degree of Islamization in Muslim societies. You know, Indonesia before the fall of Suharto was kind of limited. After the fall of Suharto and first the greening of Suharto and then the fall of Suharto and then the Islamization of Indonesia and the move, you know, from Abangan to centrification in Indonesia. So you see this Islamization in all Muslim societies at different stages, of course. So we try to kind of bring that to bear by informing policymakers. The second theme that we tried, or trend that we tried to explain, was that the U.S. response, the U.S. official response to terrorism was not helpful, did not help our relations with the Muslim world, and in fact was turning the vast majority of Muslims against the United States because of this perception that we viewed the Islamic world through the prism of terrorism. Now, the third and very related point, and that is of course, confirmed in all kinds of public opinion polls. So if you study the Pew poll, the Gallup poll, and other polls, Zogby poll, University of Maryland, BBC, over the last few years, you see that this opposition, this so-called dislike of America, it's not an opposition over values or ideas, but it is one over policies. It is driven by policies rather than by values. So when I would brief a senior policymaker on this issue, say, okay, I understand it, but what does that mean for us? What should we do about it? Why is this important? Of course this is important, because our standing in the Muslim world has, of course, diminished significantly. But if our standing used to be high, and if it is driven by policies, because of specific policies, our standing has gone down, then it is reversible. And this is a key argument that the book makes, that this low position that we have in the Islamic world is reversible. And it is reversible because it is won over policies rather than over values. And the reason is that when we asked Muslim interlocutors or interviewees whether they supported ideas of transparent and accountable government, or whether they supported ideas of representative government, whether they supported ideas of free press, well, vast majorities would answer in the affirmative. Well, obviously, then, those ideas that we consider ideas of good governance were accepted by majorities of Muslims worldwide. So if these are the ideas that we equate with good governance, then it is not ideas that Muslims are opposed to. It is policies. And then when we later pushed them to identify what policies in some of these polls, and they identified some policies, they identified them as they emerged, such as Abu Ghraib, for example. Some were kind of perennial. One of those perennial policies was the Arab-Israeli issue and the lack of a resolution of that conflict. Another one, of course, is the invasion of Iraq and the invasion of Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban. Because right before the fall of the Taliban, we got pretty good support for our actions in Afghanistan until the fall of the Taliban. But our continued presence there and military operations there has raised that issue. Another was, of course, Guantanamo. And Guantanamo now, of course, a number of books have been written and reports, whether it's the classified reports that have been leaked or other journalistic reports have clearly indicated, and most people agree, that Guantanamo has been a black spot on our history and on our relations with the Muslim world. It destroyed a whole generation. It cost us quite a bit. And I think the previous administration really did not truly understand the tremendous damage that Guantanamo, the phenomenon of Guantanamo, has caused. And I'm very happy to see that the Obama administration has decided to close that, and they are now actively pursuing a disposition of the cases of the 245 detainees that are left there. And I think within a year, hopefully Guantanamo will be something in the past. And also they identified the bellicose rhetoric against Iran. So these policies have been identified as policies that have caused a negative Islamic reaction to the United States. In addition, the other theme that or trend that we try to brief, and the book talks about it, and that is the growing debate within the Muslim world itself. Now, unfortunately, much of that debate has not been translated into English. You see, fortunately, there are a number of academic blogs, and they translate some of these articles, and they put them on these blogs. But there is a tremendous, vibrant debate going on in the Muslim world about participation in politics, about change from within, about the role of Islamic organizations and Islamic political parties. And we used to argue and really debate, and I kind of mentioned that a bit in the book because some of it was redacted from the book, really. But there was a lot of debate whether we should engage Islamic political parties. And our view was very basic and simple. You know, none of these ideas really is a rocket science. And that is, you cannot talk about reform in Egypt, political reform or economic reform, for example, without engaging the Muslim Brotherhood. You cannot talk about political reform or economic reform in Palestine without engaging Hamas. The same thing applies to Hezbollah in Lebanon. I mean, and it applies to many other political parties across the Muslim world. We studied over 130 political parties, Islamic political parties and groups, for years throughout the Muslim world. We practically interviewed most of those parties, and from the extreme right to the extreme left. And so we would come back with a report. We call it TDY trip report, and we would summarize it and put a page or two in the PDB, that is the President's Daily Brief, and would go downtown. Every time I came back from a trip, I would go downtown and brief on it. And the same theme emerged. We would need to engage these parties. So the debate then was within the administration and in the Muslim world, and it's a fair question, I guess, it used to be, not any longer really, have they made this shift strategically or tactically? Now, somebody in the administration would kind of try to challenge me. How do we know that these parties have made it strategic shift? You know, finally, I got tired of this. I said, this is the wrong question. And this person, very high level, did not like it. I said, this is the wrong question. Let's focus on their behavior, on their performance in parliaments after they are elected. Now, I said, I'm prepared to argue not one party, after they were elected to national legislatures, has demanded the institution of Sharia. Not one party. I mean, when Hamas was elected in 06, and I talked to a Hamas person, and I asked him, okay, when are you going to institute Sharia? He looked at me, he said, give me a break. What Sharia? He said, we have no time for Sharia. He said, we are interested in work permits to go to Israel. We are interested in getting the power grid from Israel. We are interested in opening commerce, both from Israel and from Egypt, overland and in the tunnels. So you are interested in daily life, you see, in daily issues. And in fact, when you look at Hamas's agenda and platform during the election, they did not highlight their Islamic identity, really. They highlighted two things: their support to the community and their muqawama, or resistance to the occupation. They probably learned, Bob Hefner is here, they learned from PAS in Malaysia, after PAS lost one of the two states. And I went to Malaysia and asked PAS, I said, how come you lost that state? And they were very honest, really. And they said, because we highlighted our Islamic credentials too much. He said, we should have done something different. And we have clear indications that Hamas contacted PAS before the elections, and Hamas contacted APK in Turkey before the elections, and they focus on highlighting their support to the community and their credentials as a resistance, as a Muqawama party. And the point we tried to make was that this debate continues in the Islamic world. There is whether even right now, I consider part of the negative debate is that whether it's efficacious for Islamic parties to participate in government, because they have not been able to deliver to their constituents. And unfortunately, the ones who are pushing this are really two poles on both ends. One is the regimes trying to discredit those parties, which doesn't make much sense to me. And the other is the neo-Salafists, who are pushing a very radical, very Salafi, intolerant, introvert, exclusivist view of Islam. And you see that, and it's really of concern to me. It's of concern to the U.S. government. It's of concern to many mainstream Muslims. And you see that in Gaza. You see that in Egypt. You see that in Yemen. You see that in parts of Indonesia. You see that in parts of Morocco. It's not a major thing, but you see this tendency of a neo-Salafist tendency. When you compare Hamas, even Hamas is opposing that. The Muslim Brotherhood is opposing that. So Hamas is like the height of moderation when you compare them to the new Salafi tendencies in Gaza that is taking hold of Gaza. So we try to point out this debate. And the most important issue that we try to point out to policymakers is that we need to understand the Islamic world much, much better. We need to assign resources to engaging the Islamic world. And that engaging the Islamic world is not just, with all due respect to my Muslim friends, it's not just because we love Muslims. It is a matter of national security and national interest. That the United States cannot continue to just ignore 1.4 billion Muslims. So even if you take a million or 2 million or even 1 billion or a part of it, I mean, a part of a portion of that, you still have over a billion Muslims to deal with. How can you ignore it? And secondly, we are not talking about 200-300 radical Mormons, you know, in some village in southwest Utah. You are talking about communities of Muslims all over the world, in Muslim-majority countries and Muslim-minority countries. You talk about the new ijtihad. We try, for example, to talk about this rising ijtihad outside in Europe and elsewhere. And of course, we always use the case of Tariq Ramadan. It is still mentioned in the book. This is one of those issues that were redacted from my book, but the issue itself remains in the book. And Tariq Ramadan upset me very much, not him, but the case of Tariq Ramadan. You are all familiar with him. And I cite this as only a case to show that there were moderate Muslims and Islamic thinkers and Muslim thinkers whose names we proposed and we suggested to the administration as moderate voices they needed to talk to And of course, they didn't. Tariq Ramadan, of course, most of you probably are familiar with his case. In 2004, he was given a contract to teach at Notre Dame. Notre Dame is not really the hotbed of radicalism, of course. It's a mainstream Catholic school. And 3 weeks before he was supposed to come here, after he made arrangements to come for his family, an apartment and schools, and so on, his visa was revoked. And so a number of academic institutions and organizations, including MESA and the American Association of Teachers of Religion, a huge, huge organization, and they wrote letters in protest to Secretary Powell and to Tommy Ridge at Department of Homeland Security protesting that. Well, Secretary Powell got very angry, and because he heard that it was intelligence, for intelligence reasons, that this guy was kept out. And so then some of us got involved. I have to be kind of vague a bit in here. Some of us got involved, and the conclusion wasn't, it was not intelligence at all. You know, that's a problem, by the way, a side issue that is facing the Department of Justice as we speak, the so-called raw intelligence about so many people in Guantanamo. And they said, well, his raw intelligence file has so much stuff. Well, when some of us looked at that, perhaps I would say 80-some pieces of 90-some pieces in that file were newspaper clippings. But because it was in a raw intelligence file, then it had a certain aura that you and I were not supposed to kind of question, you see. And in any case, so he was finally, the decision was made to rescind the revocation, but that the news did not get to him until late October. By then it was too late for him to come and teach here. And so he's teaching in Europe and so on. So we tried to show that there is vibrancy happening in the Islamic world, that there is more debate going on, that even for Muslim minorities in Europe and elsewhere that try to reconcile faith with citizenship in non-Muslim societies. And the basic arguments that the book makes I would like also to make here. I already alluded to them. One, that we need to decouple the war or the fight against terror. First, we need to stop using those phrases, and it's great that the Obama administration has stopped using those phrases. We need to decouple the fight against terror from the larger Islamic world. Two, we need to find ways to engage the Islamic world systematically and clearly and at the highest levels of government. And that three, the U.S. low standing is reversible and should be reversed and can be reversed. And that four, that this effective, for it to be effective, this type of engagement has to be based on mutual respect, justice, and fairness, and that we need to recapture our image, previous image, of being an honest broker in the Arab-Israeli issue. Now, who to engage with? I said this is very debatable. We can easily identify legitimate, credible, I used to use the word agents of change, but that's kind of a dangerous word, groups and organizations in these countries that we need to engage with. That includes Islamic political parties. I might be speaking out of school in here, but except that to say that there was a lot of debate after the Hamas election within the government whether to engage Hamas or not. Unfortunately, that debate did not last more than 48 hours. And those who were arguing for engaging Hamas lost that debate. I'm now, in retrospect, sorry to say that. Because what happened in Gaza, to a large extent, is a direct result of the refusal of the previous administration to engage Hamas. So engaging the Islamic parties was the case in point. We are engaging also local associations and groups that are essentially not political, but are influential in those villages. I mean, I spent a month in the Fergana Valley in Central Asia one time, and I went to villages and spoke to, my wife was with me, so we spoke to a number of women's organizations. Women's organizations in villages that are not political were focusing on spousal abuse, child abuse, hygienes, and so on. But they were very influential and very credible in those communities. And so if you want to bring about change, well, you need to engage those. Of course, most of you know that in previous years, we've talked to Muslims, of course, but who did we talk to? We talked to elites. I always say, you know, we talk to Western-educated, English-speaking, scotch-drinking Muslims. Well, I mean, now most Muslims are not Western-educated, are barely high school-educated. We need to talk to those people and their teachers. We've never talked to teachers, associations of teachers, representing grade school and high school students, or working with high school or grade school students. We need to talk to those teachers. So then we need to engage, and so therefore to understand these groups with whom we need to engage, we have to have expertise. We have to develop expertise in the U.S. government to learn who are these groups. And then with this out of the way, then we tried to propose 10 recommendations, I call it a blueprint in the book, to engage the Muslim world. Now, I have a couple of points to make about these things. One is that not one of these 10 except one is new. We had briefed on these, and we briefed on them from the field perspective. That is, you know, I used to go home, especially after 9/11, and after briefing in the White House, and then my wife would ask me, wasn't I frustrated that they were not listening? I said, well, you know, we believed in two things as professional intelligence officers. One, we were only one voice; they had the right and liberty to listen to other voices, so they listened to all kinds of other voices, from within the government and from outside the government. So we were one voice. And second, we truly believed that we did not make policy. I truly believe that. My senior analysts believe that. And so we would offer suggestions and briefings based on what we felt would resonate positively in the Muslim world, based on our field trips, on our field analysis, and on our interviews. So most of these recommendations are not new. They have been briefed before. But we kind of thought that we better kind of really re-emphasize them. And the first, and I kept it in the book, even though we did appoint an ambassador, was to appoint an ambassador to the OIC. Now, that was a very controversial idea the first time we briefed it. And that was probably about 4 years ago. And the controversial idea, not from the Muslim world's perspective, but from the Washington bureaucracy perspective. And there was really a serious argument back and forth. And we thought that the Muslim world would respond positively to the appointment of a distinguished American Muslim. And as you know, the American Muslim community has made unbelievable strides in all fields, in all walks of life, from space science to Fortune 500. If you look at the Pew poll in 2007 of American Muslims, you would be really very impressed by their achievements. So a distinguished American Muslim, unfortunately, has got to be a male. Sorry about the ladies in the room. Preferably Sunni, not only accomplished in his field, but also with deep knowledge of Islam and of languages, one of the languages spoken there, Arabic or Urdu or Farsi or Bahasa Indonesia or whatever language that large numbers of Muslims, Turkish, large number of Muslims, although the Turks don't like to be identified as an Islamic state, but one of those languages, so that this person can go to Mecca, can go to OIC meetings, can discuss with them issues. Well, you know, when right before I retired, the majority leader of the Senate asked for a personal briefing. And as Dick said, well, he asked for Emil to come down. So I went down there and went to his sanctorum there. You see the inside office of the majority leader, very impressive. He gave me a fantastic lunch, very nice sandwich, really, and potato chips. So then we were talking, and then at the end he said, I understand you are leaving the government. I said, yeah. He said, well, you will be that ambassador. I said, Senator, I said, a Catholic from Nazareth doesn't cut it. It's got to be a distinguished American Muslim, you see. Well, finally, the president did speak at the Islamic Center in Washington in 07. And last year, finally, he did appoint a special envoy to the OIC, whose term ended with the president. Now, I will not say anything bad about this person. In fact, he's a very nice person. I met him, and we know him well. But, you know, this person is a friend of the president from Texas, a Bangladeshi businessman who is Ismaili, not even Shia, and he was appointed without discussion with State Department. The State Department did not even like the idea. So I decided to keep that suggestion here, that recommendation, because we do need to appoint a distinguished American Muslim, and that such a person should have an office in the White House at the NSC and an office at State Department. He should be the main spokesman for the United States, because we were oftentimes asked, every time Karen Hughes would go overseas, then we would ask, well, is she speaking for the president? When the Secretary of State would say something, who is speaking? We would always be asked from the field, who is speaking for the U.S. government? So we thought, even though the message has to be tailor-made and for specific audiences, but it's got to be by one messenger. And hence the appointment of the ambassador, and we continue really to believe that this is an important recommendation. I don't want to go through all the recommendations except to highlight a few of them. One of the recommendations that might be controversial is the creation of an imamate university in this country. That is not a government university, but that you would have the top universities in this country would get together and we're working together with OIC perhaps, or moderate Muslim universities in the Muslim world, in Turkey, in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Cairo, in Morocco, and Jordan, and other places, and come up with a program of studies that we would consider a tolerant interpretation, reflects a tolerant interpretation of Islam. And that we would have a graduate university with a graduate training in imamate. This is important because we have discovered, this is now from the terrorist perspective, that a number of these radical imams tend to have been educated according to a very narrow interpretation of Islam. Probably you probably can't tell at what universities, probably in Saudi Arabia. And then they become enablers, and they become recruiters, and they become not helpful in the presentation of a moderate, and I hate really the word moderate, I keep using tolerant, in a tolerant a view of Islam. And so this calls for the establishment of such a university here, and that where not only American students can study, but also students from overseas can come and study here. So far, we only have one university, I think, is the Hartford Seminary, that gives a certificate in chaplaincy. That is Muslim chaplains to serve as Muslim chaplains in the U.S. Armed Services, I think they get their license, if you will, their certificate from the Hartford Seminary. There is another recommendation which also connects both the credibility of the engagement and the security issue, and that is the 10th recommendation. And I've been working on that in the last 2 years since I retired, because before I retired as an agency, we cannot deal really with U.S. persons or focus on U.S. persons. But since I retired, I've been working with DHS on this issue, and that is American Muslims, for the last 2 years. And the conclusion is that we need to engage the American Muslim community if our engagement to the wider Islamic world is going to be credible. That we need to get this credibility through engaging the American Muslim community in the process. That the American Muslim community can act not only as a bridge, but as an active partner in this engagement process. Yeah, and that is good for security reasons, and it's good for public policy and public diplomacy reasons. I've focused on that for the last 2 years, as I said, with the DHS, and I think there are some headways made have been made in this area. Normally, you always think of the wider Islamic world, and especially, I mean, this is particularly important because, luckily, fortunately, unlike Europe, we really don't have "quote unquote" a Muslim problem in this country. Unlike the British or unlike the other European countries. And the reason is that for the most part, except for very few recent immigrants, for the most part, the Muslim community has integrated in this society and has really worked to become part and parcel of this society. And so therefore they can contribute significantly to this engagement process with the Muslim world. And as I said, this is not rocket science, but it is important. Now, the final couple of points I want to make is that this engagement cannot be done on the cheap and requires a deep commitment, serious commitment in resources, and perhaps even some reorganization in the U.S. government in Washington. Because I know some State Department folks opposed that recommendation from the very beginning because they want to control it, and not the government or the NSC. They want to control the process, and they want to decide what ambassador should be appointed or not. But this engagement might require a restructuring within the U.S. government. Indeed, on a very minor, micro level, the creation of the political PISAB that Dick and Tom and Bob and the others are familiar with was not created easily without much bureaucratic infighting, and we fought for it and we won because they saw the logic of it, the need for it. So what I'm saying here is that this engagement process is not going to be just assigned to somebody part-time to do it, or some low-level functionary at the NSC to do it, because that's what happened in the last 8 years about engaging the Islamic world, and that's why it did not work. And it should be, this reminds me of one time I took a trip to Israel to study the Islamic movement in Israel. That was the first time we've ever even attempted to analyze the Islamic movement in Israel. And our person at the embassy, he said, well, you should talk to this gentleman. He's from State Department. He's at the embassy who deals with this issue. So I went to him and I said, a very nice gentleman, and I said, how do you cover this? He said, he covers it part-time. I said, you are dealing with 1 million people. You cover it only part-time? He said, yeah, unfortunately, we don't have the resources. I said, do you speak Arabic? He said, no. I said, do you speak Hebrew? He said, no. I said, how do you cover him? Well, of course, I knew how he covered him. He spoke to all those who spoke English. you see, and who would meet him at bars and at restaurants, and that's these are the people, because I spoke to every one of them, his contacts, and then from there, you know, went musk hopping and musk crashing and spoke to the rest of them. But we need to have this as a major government commitment at the highest level to say we need to engage 1.4 Muslims all over the world that have contributed in so many different cultures and societies. And so therefore it cannot be done on the cheap, and it cannot be done just by even existing government structures. And it seems to me, unless we do that, the process is going to fail, and then that chasm, if you will, between us and the Islamic world is going to be to remain. Because every time the previous president made statements about democracy and about liberty and about reaching out to the Islamic world, it had a bounce. Those statements had a bounce, a positive bounce, but the bounce did not last because there were no policies followed those statements. And that's why I quoted one interlocutor in the book saying, well, where is the beef? You know, we are tired of hearing speeches. We need programs. We need policies. And it seems to me, if we do that, if we believe that it is a matter of national security, that it is, and we assign the right resources, and long-term commitment in expertise, then I think through that we can recapture our past image of hope and of liberty and of human dignity and the rule of law. Thank you. I will perhaps stop.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations at Boston University. Speaking was author Emil Nakhli. Dr. Nakhli's lecture was titled A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. He was introduced by Boston University Anthropology Department Professor of International Relations, Augustus Norton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jared Mooney and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.